You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 18th of March 2024 on Monocle Radio.
Russia concludes its special electoral operation, the gathering backlash against open borders, and what treasures and/or scandals may be lurking in your attic. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests, Julie Norman and Petri Bertsov, will discuss today's big stories. And we'll hear from the comedy writer Joel Morris, who has written a book which, at the risk of doing him out of work, attempts to explain how comedy works. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined today by Julie Norman, Associate Professor of Politics and International Relations at UCL, and by Petri Bertsov, Monocle's Helsinki correspondent, who instead of being in Helsinki is here in London. Welcome both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Petri, we do usually get first-time daily guests to introduce themselves a bit on their debut appearance. This is quite a strange liminal status you occupy because your voice is, of course, very familiar to our listeners, but your position as a daily panellist is not. So for that strata of listener who rigorously avoids all of Monocle's output apart from the daily, introduce yourself.
Yes, so for that one listener out of all the millions who listen to Monocle Radio every day, my name is Petri Bertsov and I work as Monocle's correspondent in Helsinki. I've been doing that since 2016, and in addition to Helsinki, keep an eye also on the other Nordic countries and the Baltic states as well.
Of course, and what does bring you to London other than being on the daily?
Want to see new faces here at Midori House, because those are the faces that I pitch stories to. So it's always, you know, go out in the evening for one or two or 10 pints, and then lo and behold, all my stories go through.
Is that how it's done? Julie, you have not been anywhere of late, but you are, as I understand it, going to what I think is one of the United States' most underrated cities this weekend.
That's right. I am going home for the Easter break, and I'm going out to Utah, to Salt Lake City, where my sister lives. And as they like to say out there, it is beautiful, and so I highly recommend it to you.
I've suddenly gone off it.
Guess disconnected. But no, if you like the parks, like the outdoors, recommend it.
It is a lovely city. It does always strike me as a remarkably well-organized and well-run kind of place.
It is. I feel like they have it kind of put together. They know what they're doing out there. A lot of people skip over from California to Colorado, but Utah, gotta say, it's happening.
And for an American city, it actually has relatively functional public transport.
It does. It's a very functional place, I gotta say. They have their stuff together out there, so.
Big hello to all our Utah listeners. But we will start with Russia's presidential election, and also a big hello to those many of our listeners who got a few tins in and stayed up all night to see the votes coming in from the key swing oblasts of Astrakhan, Chelyabinsk, Volgograd and Omsk. Beneath which leaden sarcasm is, of course, the headline that the winner was the incumbent president, Vladimir Putin, winning just over 88% of the vote, a landslide whose path was arguably smoothed somewhat by a rigorous pre-election program of disqualifying, imprisoning, exiling or murdering anybody who might have proved meaningful opposition. Julie, first of all, this is pretty much the result we might have expected.
Well, absolutely. I don't think anyone was waited with bated breath. From what I've seen, the percentage, that 87%, was even higher than some analysts thought it might be. And it's obviously something that, you know, Putin will emphasize, I think, going forward. But right, from everyone watching from the West, you know, it's been pretty unanimous from the U.S., from the U.K., from across Europe. These were not free and fair elections, so the result is pretty much what everyone expected it to be.
Now, Petri, you don't think there's any other explanation for that 10-point bump in his numbers since 2018? He's just becoming more and more popular.
That's how it is, Andrew. As someone living in Finland, we know how Russia works. But I have to mention here that I looked at Finland's main daily, Helsingin Sanomat. There was a story about Russians who live and reside in Finland and who voted, and only about 11% of them voted for Putin, apparently. So you know,
well,
something.
I guess outside Russia, that's a choice you have. But, I mean, I was wondering, Julie, if you look at the second-placed candidate, which was Nikolai Karitonov, the Communist Party candidate, he did fall 73 million votes short. Is there anything perhaps he could have done to reel some of that in?
I think maybe he didn't tap into TikTok well enough, didn't kind of get the younger voters this time around. I'll just decide, right? I mean, I think the most we can say for this election was the number of people who came out for the protest at noon vote yesterday on Sunday to show some sense of opposition, even though that's not really reflected in the numbers.
I mean, Petri, while you are here, we will be prevailing upon you for the Finnish perspective on various things as we make our way through tonight's show. But given that this, you know, election was obviously a foregone conclusion, did it really register as a story in Finland, or do Finland just assume that Russia is Russia and Putin is Putin and the odd sham election here or there doesn't make all that much difference to anything?
It was the main news story still. But of course, everybody knew the result. I think people in Finland were mostly interested in Putin's victory speech. What's he going to say about Finland and Sweden joining the NATO and about, you know, potential military buildup on the Finnish border? He's alluded to that before, but in terms of the result, you know, that was exactly what everybody expected.
Just on that point, though, does anybody in Finland, or is the threat from Russia taken seriously in Finland? Because obviously it was taken seriously enough 2 years ago that Finland and Sweden both applied to join NATO. But it has struck me that Putin's view of that has actually been quite muted. He's been, obviously he's obsessed with Ukraine, but the whether or not it reflects what he actually thinks, the Russian line on Sweden and Finland joining NATO has been not far away from "we'll see if we care."
Yeah, true. And I think it's important to bear in mind that Finland and Sweden have not been exactly neutral even before joining NATO. So, you know, Russia has probably in all likelihood treated Finland and Sweden sort of as, you know, very close NATO, if not members, at least allies before. So in terms of pure military strategy, it's not necessarily such a big change. Mind you, Putin has said that where NATO bases or more NATO troops to be transferred to Finland, then they would have to react to that and transfer more troops to the Finnish border. The question is, I mean, where would those troops come from? Mm-hmm. He's already quite hard-pressed in Ukraine as we speak. So,
I mean, Julie, the responses to the election have been every bit as predictable as the election itself. He has received congratulations from China, Iran, Venezuela, Republika Srpska, and India, which is what you might expect, and it has been condemned by all the people you would expect to condemn it. But on the subject of condemnation, is there even any point to condemning it? I mean, probably the most forthright EC Council President, Charles Michel, I mean, you could see the gag he's making here because he did tweet this in advance of polls opening. He said, would like to congratulate Vladimir Putin on his landslide victory in the election starting today, but then followed that up with no opposition, no freedom, no choice. That's all true as far as it goes, but does this help?
You know, I think it's it may not help, but to not do it, I think, is also a bit of an omission. And, you know, the whole world is going to see these headlines. They're going to see the numbers. And so I do think, you know, for a lot of Monocle listeners, it may be very clear about how Russia's elections work. But to a lot of people who just see that number and who might even be hearing Russia's spin on that number or India's or Iran's spin on that number, this does make sure that the narrative is clear that these were not free and fair and does just set the record straight. It obviously doesn't change anything in Russia, but ensures that the public does know what is going on.
He is more or less right now, Vladimir Putin, this is Petri, addressing a you know, dutifully delirious crowd in Red Square in Moscow. But this gives him at least six more years. And assuming, you know, he is spared even longer than that, is it now prudent for, well, not just the countries that share a border with Russia, but everybody else in Europe to proceed on the assumption that Putin is going to be there forever?
Well, not forever, but
well,
for,
you know what I mean.
for several years to come. Yes. Yes, it is. And I mean, one thing that quite often on Finnish media, when you see pundits, experts in Russia talk about the future of Putin, it's quite a sobering discussion because people often point out that whoever succeeds Putin might not be any better, might be actually worse.
You rarely lose money by betting on things getting worse in Russia.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly, exactly. So we are, as in Finland as a country, is preparing for Putin to be there for the long haul. And actually, I think it was our Prime Minister Petteri Orpo who said last week in the European Parliament that, you know, Russia seems to be also in it for the long haul and is looking for a long war, not only against Ukraine, but for a longer conflict with the West.
Julie, just finally on this, one idea for responding to this election has been floated by Vladimir Kara-Murza, who's now probably the highest profile political prisoner in Russia following the death of Alexei Navalny. Vladimir Kara-Murza has in fact sat, well, not in this studio, but in Studio 2 just across the hall. But I spoke to his wife, Evgenia Kara-Murza, last week, and she was talking about an idea he has suggested that the world, by which he means the Western democratic world, should now make a point of simply refusing to recognize Vladimir Putin as the president of Russia, much as has been done before with Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela, Alexander Lukashenko in Belarus. Would that have, any impact beyond the symbolic?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's something I wondered if we would hear any of that in the condemnation of the elections today. And I noted that, you know, that was not part of the narrative from pretty much any Western country. It was not ever kind of questioning, we aren't going to recognize Putin or do business, like kind of discuss things with him. I do think it's a really interesting strategy, and I think we should listen to what opposition activists are suggesting as a possible way down the line. I will say, when it is a conflict like this, when we're likely going to need to be trying to work with this conflict for a while and somehow find a way out of it, there's certain times where I think a move like that's probably more advantageous than others, and it seems like most governments now are not quite at that point with Putin.
Well, in Finland, meanwhile, the government is to adopt temporary legislation which will block asylum seekers attempting to enter Finland from Russia. This follows the decision late last year to close every crossing along Finland's 1,340 kilometres of border with Russia. Probably fair enough in the circumstances, but not sufficient to deter asylum seekers from countries including Yemen, Somalia and Syria, who Finland alleges, again not implausibly, that Russia has been encouraging towards the border. Though the particulars are unusual, the generalities are not. A backlash against migration and asylum is currently something of a political motif in many countries. Petri, first of all, to Finland's latest move, how big a thing has this been lately of refugees from countries a very, very, very long way from Russia or Finland turning up, trying to make their way across that border?
Well, we've seen quite significant, and when I say quite significant, we have to remember Finland is a country of 5 million people, so when we have a few thousand asylum seekers, that's a lot to us. You know, that's, if you put it into context, that would be tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, coming into the UK. So it's been a big, big thing. But having said that, the numbers are still, if it was merely a refugee situation, they would be manageable numbers. You know, we're talking a few thousand people. Finland took on, I think it was 15,000 when in the 2015 refugee crisis. So it's about more than that. And the Finnish government argues that some of these asylum seekers constitute what they say is a security threat, that the Russian government has instrumentalized them in a way that they might sabotage, or they're in other ways a security risk. And that is the justification. That's how they legitimize this new law, which flies in the face of international treaties such as the Geneva Convention.
Julie, you are also from a country in which I think it's fair to say immigration and migration and asylum and matters related are going to come up between now and November. The thing is, do you get a sense that any of the parties or politicians that you might think of as being broadly in favour have figured out an actually constructive and enticing way to respond to the issue? Because for the person who takes, or politician who takes, the anti-immigration line, that's easy. You can say things like, we're crowded, our public services are overrun, we have poor people here who should be our first priority, none of which is necessarily inaccurate. Those are all makeable, entirely reasonable, rational, makeable cases, but they're also a very easy one to say. Has anybody succeeded yet in actually making the case for a certain amount of generosity where this is concerned.
I think we're not hearing that right now in the United States, and especially in this election year. And Biden has really been much more centrist and even open to a lot of GOP proposals around immigration. He floated last month an offer where the president could just unilaterally close the border when it was getting too crowded, something that Democrats never thought Biden would be willing to do. That deal fell apart with Republicans. Even that was not far enough. But right now, the U.S. border, I think there's over 200,000 crossings per month right now. And so just on a humanitarian level, there's just not the infrastructure to process, to absorb the number of asylum seekers coming. And for Republicans, this is a security crisis. For most Democrats, this is a humanitarian crisis. And so both, I think, are going to be focused on the border, but no one has really been able to come up with a reasonable way to be able to make this, to improve the situation in any way.
Because, Petri, this is the trap that the anti-immigration parties or politicians lure their opponents into, because by definition, they make you say, no, it's great, we should let all these people in. There's a temptation, I think, to take the opposite position, which is fairly self-evidently, just for all the, you know, realistic and logistical reasons Julie mentions, also kind of a ridiculous position.
Yeah, yeah, that's correct. And what has happened in Finland, I think, you know, just for our listeners to know, that Finns as a population, as a country, they're quite, you know, we trust our authorities. And now when we hear from our security police that some of these asylum seekers, they are criminal, the term they used is criminal elements. So Finns believe that, even though there's, you know, no proof has been shown. When journalists ask, they say that, you know, this is top secret, we cannot tell you why. So that's why even those on the left and those in the political center, they support I've seen polls, the majority of Finns support these hardline measures.
I mean, just finally on this one, Julie, because I think it is the eternal question which underpins this issue, and it is especially illustrative, I think, in a country like the United States, or indeed like my country, Australia, which is substantially a nation of immigrants and the people descended from them, many of whom would never have been able to grow up there had extremely strict rules been imposed. I mean, for all that, certain of my own ancestors didn't really go of their own accord. But nevertheless, is what people object to, apart from those that hardcore who actually are just militant racist xenophobes and cannot be reasoned with, but I try to be optimistic about this and think maybe what people object to is not so much immigrants and immigration. They don't like disorder. They don't like the idea that it's a free-for-all, that there's no plan, there's no organization, and nobody's in charge.
Well, that's true. And I do think, right, if you look at polling and if you look at, right, a nation like the United States that's largely immigrant-based too, most people do support legal immigration. Mm. And I would say that is ideally the middle road, where you try and open up many new avenues for legal immigration. And the U.S. is notoriously bad on that. It's anyone who's ever tried to get a visa to the United States, you know, it's very difficult. And so that is an area where Biden was trying to make some movement earlier in his term, but that just didn't get very far, and there's needs a lot more. But I would say that is a big distinction. And I would say even for immigrant communities within the United States, it often polls very much that way, where, you know, even recent immigrants say, we just don't want other people kind of cheating the system and coming in illegally.
Well, on a related theme, listeners who have been able to bring themselves to pay much attention to the US presidential election thus far will be aware that border security is going to be quite an issue between now and November. But we can, of course, be secure in the knowledge that the matter will be discussed calmly, constructively, and in pure-hearted good faith by people who certainly are not attempting to leverage the yearnings of the huddled masses in the service of inane partisan point scoring. In the US, the border security issue also threatens to further enhance the general gaiety by bringing about a shutdown of the federal government later this week. Julie, as the person who is here at this table taking complete responsibility for literally everything the United States does, could you please briefly explain to our many listeners and, frankly, the presenter of this program, who are wondering what? How is this a thing? What actually is this? What does a government shutdown mean, and why do we keep having to read about it and having to try to explain it all over again?
Yes, well, I will say this is kind of like the boy that cried wolf kind of story, because it comes up all the time, because we were always on the edge of a shutdown. And this is because the U.S. needs to pass an annual budget each year. Mm-hmm. If we don't pass that by a certain point...
So does everybody.
So does every country, which usually can manage it, yes. And you would think that the United States would maybe have figured out how to do it by now. But this usually becomes a big area for partisan point scoring, and especially in an election year. So what we've seen this time around, they've been trying to do this since the fall, and usually they keep just postponing it. Instead of actually agreeing on a budget, they say we'll agree to push it another 2 months or another 6 weeks. And so we keep seeing this moving of the goalposts for passing the budget. But each time it comes up to this deadline, we risk the government shutting down.
Petri, speaking on behalf, as you are, for every other nation on earth that isn't the United States, does this recurrent spectacle, do you think, diminish America in the eyes of the world? Or by now, do we just understand it as one of those local eccentricities that the Americans get up to for reasons surpassing understanding, but okay, fine?
I think, Andrew, my response would have been different had you asked 10 or five years ago. But I think now we just expect that anything is possible in that country. But I mean, it does paint a picture of a somewhat dysfunctional administration if it comes up pretty much every year, that why cannot it be fixed? But then, as I said, there are many other issues that appear a little bit dysfunctional to a non-American audience.
And Julie, it is all about partisan point scoring, as you suggested, but does it actually work in terms of partisan point scoring? Does anybody have any evidence that this shifts any votes at all, or does everybody just blame the other side until we move on to whatever we're going to do this about next?
Tends to be more finger-pointing. I will say there are often times where you do see this is where compromises can happen. So we've seen this in the past with President Biden, the former Speaker McCarthy, where that's actually where they hammered out something, and then because of that, McCarthy was ousted from his speaker role. So sometimes it happens, but it's often at great risk, especially to the person in Congress who's negotiating it. So I would say this time around, I'm not super optimistic. This time around, though, there's a lot on the table. The border, which we've been talking about, Ukraine aid, which we've kind of been alluding to. So all these things are real things in the budget. This isn't just some dollars and cents that may or may not affect people. Like, these are real issues that we'll feel the effect of them not going through.
And Petri, if we're trying to see an upside in this, is this yet another on the now towering heap of reminders to Europe that it needs to get serious about looking after itself, that it will not or may not always be able to rely on the United States?
Yes, I think it is. And it's one in the rather long list of things that have happened that have forced Europe to adopt that kind of thinking. But I have to say, I have to ask you, Julia, I'm interested in what happens if there is, has there ever been an actual shutdown? What happens then?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes, it has happened. Yeah. And it's shut down for weeks. And their essential workers still work, but it means that most people in D.C. are forced to stay home. They get paid on furlough later. But military people, even those are not getting paid during that time. So it's not a good situation for the U.S. to be in. And that is where we look, I think, quite vulnerable to adversaries overseas as well when an actual shutdown goes into effect.
Just finally on, well, not quite this, Julie, but in a political development from the United States today, former President Donald Trump is apparently unable the $464 million that he needs to come up with to meet the civil fraud judgment in New York State. I mean, I'm not going to ask the question, surely this is the end for Donald Trump, because if I had $10, frankly, for every time I've asked that, I might actually be able to help him out. But this is, well, literally and metaphorically, no small change.
It's true. I mean, and this issue of Trump hitting financial difficulties has kind of lurked behind some of the more sensational headlines, I think, of things he's saying or the big court rulings. It might actually be the finances that ends up stressing him the most. But as we've seen time and time again, Trump seems to find a way. And I think if his supporters know he's in trouble, they will kick into gear. And he also finds a way legally often to postpone things that need doing. So
Well, to now the melancholy task of sorting the belongings of a deceased parent. Never say that we, the Monocle Daily, do not start your week with a smile and a chuckle. In the annoyingly spelled US state of Massachusetts, one family undertaking this dismal ritual was surprised to discover in their late father's attic a trove of Japanese antiquity, certain items of which were listed on the FBI's National Stolen Art File and which have now been repatriated to Japan. The relics appear to have been lifted during or after the Battle of Okinawa, and though their late owner did serve in World War II, he did not serve in the Pacific Theatre, a puzzle which the Monocle Daily is frankly not qualified to address, unless somebody at the table would like to have a crack at improvising a theory. How is it that this man who did not serve in the Pacific passes away leaving an attic full of nicked Japanese treasure? Anybody?
Must have been a mistress.
That's not a bad thought. Either a mistress or he was acting as a fence for somebody. But anyway, while we await, doubtless, the interminable Netflix series dramatising the whole thing, we did want to open up to the topics of attics and cellars. So first I must ask, and I'll ask you first, Petri, do you in fact, where you live, have an attic or a cellar, or have you ever had one?
I in fact happen to live in an attic.
Amazing. So if I ask the people who live in the house where you live, what do you have in your attic? They would reply, Petri Bertsov.
Exactly. And lots of bags full of dollars, of course. No, but to be serious, I mean, not in my attic. I don't think I have anything super valuable except for all of my Monocle gear. But I have previously gone through some of the attics that belong to my relatives who live in rather bigger houses. And I have found, if not exactly a Japanese art, but at least some valuable items.
Like what?
Like some vintage Itala and Arabia Finnish plates and mugs, which happen to be quite valuable these days since those companies have done some rebrandings recently, and some of the old stuff is now super, super valuable. So I happen to have a collection of mugs from, I believe it's the 1950s, which I'm planning to actually keep because it's probably going to increase in value better than the euros on my bank account.
See, that's quite exciting. I have a cellar which is mostly used as storage space by various musician friends of mine. I have like the world's worst rock and roll museum down there. if any listeners would like to come round and see Jesus Jones' spare drum kit, call it £5 and I'll throw in a cup of tea. Julie, do you have or have you ever had a cellar or an attic which you may or may not ever have found things in?
No, if I could find something, we'd be finding the attic. I've never lived in a place that had one. So my grandma used to have a good attic and basement that as kids, that was like one of the highlights of visiting her was to go creep around in both of them and try and scare my siblings. But
I lived in one house in Sydney which had in its attic something you do not want in your attic, which is possums.
Whoa.
Yeah, they make a hell of a din. They run around at night. And to be very clear, having them removed is not a job for the enthusiastic amateur. You need to get proper people with really quite extraordinary protective equipment.
I would think so.
They've got teeth and claws, apparently. Petri, as well, because we wanted to talk about running across family scandals, have you ever run across any such thing?
Never. It never happens in my family. We are scandal-free.
See, I have alluded, Julie, to my own family scandal at the time, but it is well and truly public knowledge by now, which is that, you know, certain of my mother's ancestors enabled their passage to the colony of New South Wales by stealing things from shops in Dublin and London. But do you have anything of that sort lurking that you know of?
Yes, a little bit. I found out a little while ago that my grandmother's first husband was killed by the mafia, and so she ended up marrying
I'm sure he had it coming.
He did. It all traced back to a card game, apparently. So, like, don't mess with my family, the card game. But so she married his brother, as was the custom at the time, and so I'm descended from that line. So if it wasn't for the mafia, I wouldn't be here with you guys.
Oh, thank God for the mafia.
Well, yeah, on that startling note, Petri Bertsov and Julie Norman, thank you both for joining us. Finally, on today's show, as attendance at any comedy club open mic will confirm, people who are actually funny are a tiny minority when measured against those who merely think they are funny. The question always posed about anything that a few people are good at, but most are not, is can it be taught? Joel Morris, who is funny, indeed funny enough to be funny for a living, thinks so. up to a point. Joel's new book is a distillation of what he has learned as a professional comedy writer. It's called Be Funny or Die: How Comedy Works and Why It Matters. I spoke to Joel at Midori House earlier, and I began by asking whether in writing the book he'd been at all nervous about giving up the tricks of his trade.
I think anyone who writes comedy, not necessarily a performer, but a writer of comedy or a fixer of comedy, which is what I am, you sort of have to know how to do it. I think I found it frustrating that people kept saying, there's no way of explaining it. And I thought, well, if there's no way of explaining it, what was I learning? Because, I mean, I'm a musician as well, and I just thought, it's the same as chords on a guitar, isn't it? There's a play-in-a-day version of comedy that you could give people, and I couldn't believe no one had even tried to explain it before.
You draw that comparison a couple of times in the book between comedians and between musicians, and it got me thinking, in terms of what you were just saying, the play-in-a-day idea, that I wonder if there is something similar with both, because it has always been my contention, having met a lot of musicians as well as a lot of writers, that you can probably teach anybody to play guitar up to a certain standard, but you can't teach everybody to be Richard Thompson. You've either got that or you haven't got it. Is the same true with comedy? Are some people just funnier?
Yeah, totally. I mean, obviously, that's the same thing with anything. The best example being, most people can probably play the bass, but not many people can play the bass well. I mean, that's a huge leap on. Mm-hmm. But the basics of it, the idea that it's inexplicable, the way that comedy has a sort of magic circle, a murta, about it says, oh, this is impossible to describe. And I talked to a neuroscientist at the very, very beginning of doing this, and I said, I'm trying to explain what comedy is. And he just went, oh, let me tell you, are you going to say it's like stage magic or music? And I went, yes. And he went, of course it is. And as a neuroscientist, he said, it's a system of tricks, and the trick is to make people not see what you're doing. You're constantly palming coins and putting cards up your sleeve and things. You've got to surprise people, but they've also got to see what's coming. And it's, the tricks are so similar. As someone who learned the, I'm not a great stage magician, but I can see, I've got friends who are, and the tricks are the same. You've got to make people look one way while you're doing something the other way. And it's really weird that we live in a world that has Penn and Teller showing you how tricks work, and we go, they're still magical. I still love going to magic shows, even though I know it's tricks. And I thought the same thing's true with comedy. You are doing a limited number of moves. There's 12 notes in the scale, but you can do an infinite number of tunes with it.
You described yourself earlier as a fixer of comedy, and again, this is something the book goes into which may not occur to, well, most consumers of comedy, because, of course, we consume it as a finished product in the same way that we do a record. We don't see the rewrites and the tinkering and the arguments that went on behind the scenes. But how does that process usually work, or how has it worked in your experience? How does it happen when somebody brings an idea to a writer's table or whatever the arrangement is and asks the always dreaded question, is this anything? And the rest of you have to try and think, maybe, maybe not, there's something here. How do we get this up to the gate?
The thing that I love about, and I found this out quite recently, I've been doing comedy for ages, and then someone, I was talking to an improviser, I was talking to Carrie Ad Lloyd, who's a brilliant live improviser, she does ostentatious and things. And she was describing her process, and I went, oh my God, that's the same as writing. And I just thought that what all writing is improv for shy people. And you don't have to do it in front of anybody, which is the weird thing is, because you don't do it in front of anybody, sometimes you don't have an audience, so you have to build better instincts on what's going to work and not going to work, because you don't get a laugh back. But you're improvising to the page. The moment you sit down on your own, you're improvising to the page. There's nothing there. You've got the germ of an idea. You've got to see where that idea goes. But if there's a bunch of you together, which often you're writing with a collaborator or a producer or a script editor, or that at best there's a writer's room, you're just trying to make each other laugh. And that takes it back to what comedy is in the first place, which is what you do with your brothers and sisters or your friends at school. You're trying to get a giggle out of each other. You're trying to get that reaction, get that soothing, happy, joyful feeling. And you just keep tinkering with it. What you mustn't do, as improvisers always tell you, is say no. You've got to keep going, what about, and keep taking the... And anyone who's ever got into a rolling giggle with a mate, taking an idea further and further, knows what that feeling's like. And I think that's what's interesting about comedy as a science, is that people go, well, you can't analyse it. And I went, but you've sat with a friend and worked an idea up until you've been in hysterical giggles. That's what you're doing.
But for all that, and for all that you do this for a living and you understand the tricks of the trade, do you ever still, I guess, whether you outthink or outclever or outsmart yourself, come up with something which you just think, oh God, this is amazing. This is a great, great gag, and you present it to whoever you're presenting it to and tumbleweed?
Yeah, a lot. I mean, but you don't know. That's one of the reasons that people collaborate a lot, I think, because you want to read stuff out. And I was sitting with Jason Hazley, who I wrote with a lot for a long time, I still write with on the Philomena Kunk series. And we were sitting in an office and a friend had come in just to use a desk. And he said, I didn't realise you kept reading jokes out to each other. And I went, oh, you do that, because otherwise you can't just sit with your headphones on and just put it to the page. We're reading the jokes out to each other in the right voice, in the bad acting. But when you were proud enough to read a joke out, that meant you wanted to hear what it sounded like out loud. You wanted to trip yourself over. And you wanted... Well, I did that when I read a joke out to a friend. I wanted to trip myself over while I'm saying it to surprise myself. And go, oh my God, hearing it out loud rather than to the page is the moment that it suddenly catches you unawares. It's surprising, even if you know what's coming, that you can still... Yeah, it's like sort of a deliberate pratfall. You trip yourself over. And at that point of surprise, you'll find yourself laughing, even if you know what's coming. I think you should laugh at your own jokes, shouldn't you? otherwise they're joyless.
Well, as colleagues here will wearily attest, I do that frequently. But one of the things I do wonder about, writing, as regular listeners will be aware, an allegedly humorous weekly review of the events of the last 7 days, and I do think about this a lot, some words are just funnier than others.
Yes.
Have you ever figured out why that is? Like why soup is a funnier word than beans? I mean, other people may disagree. Beans is itself quite a funny word.
Beans is good.
But I think soup is funnier than beans.
Here's the trick. It's not about the words, it's the words before it. The usual rule with a joke, if a joke is failing or succeeding, it's not usually to do with the joke itself, it's to do with the context, what sets it up. And one of my favourite pieces of writing advice is, if someone flags up there's a problem on page 28, look at page 2. You can stare at page 28 forever, but it'll probably be that you didn't set it up properly on page 2. Beans will be funny if the words before beans didn't make you think beans was coming. And soup will be funny if the words before soup didn't make you think soup was coming. It's all to do with jumping register, changing tone and things. You can move from, I mean, there's probably some linguistics in this. You can move from like posh Latinates to crude Anglo-Saxon words. And that jump in tone is like a king falling down a manhole. You suddenly go, oh, you were very grand, and then you're very, 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 very low. It's why swearing's funny. It's why you drop in a swear word at the end of a long, elaborate, complicated speech. Like if a politician suddenly saying bum will be funny. It's all to do with context. The words themselves can be funny. Sometimes, I mean, everyone knows there are funnier letters. We like M's and G's and things. But often it's just because
the hard C always sticks a landing nicely as well.
Yeah, exactly. And it's to do with rhythm. There's a rhythm and a music to it. Comedy is music. I just think that they are the same thing. They are patterns of expectation and surprise. And there is a delight and a rhythm to diddly-dum, diddly-dum. Shakespeare knew it. There's a diddly-dum to things. And your brain likes to play with those things. And comedy is play. It's giving you a set of toys to play with. And sometimes they tumble together like rolling little balls around and they bounce off each other nicely. But it's, you roll them around your brain until you're happy to keep fiddling with them, I think. And very often it's not the actual final word that's the key. It's the ones before it.
That was Joel Morris on his terrific new book, Be Funny or Die, How Comedy Works and Why It Matters. And that is all for this edition of The Monocle Daily. Thanks to our panellists today, Petri Bertsov and Julie Norman. Today's show was produced by Chris Chermak and researched by George Ruskin. Our sound engineer was Lily Austin. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.